Hi, everybody. I'm Philip, and I'm an alcoholic and an addict. Caught you by surprise. I'm a little nervous tonight. What I'm here for, and what I understand my job is telling my story, is to share in a general way, what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. I guess the best place to start is at the beginning. I was born in Baton Rouge, Louisiana in 1961, the youngest of four. Pretty much removed an age from my brother and sisters, not planned for, I don't think. Actually, I know. A surprise. My mom had a problem in my growing up, or just in general, with depressions. A lot of things I'll share tonight are, I'm sure, are things that I'm just becoming aware of, or just really getting a chance to learn about as a result of my being sober, that I'd like to share, and I think is important. It was difficult, and in my home, there was a real split, I think, between the way that I felt that my brother and sisters were members of the family versus myself. I felt somewhat isolated, even in our family situation, and very sensitive, very much apart from, felt very different, even from the. I can remember even from early age. My personal view is that I was born an alcoholic and an addict. Are certainly predisposed in that direction. I had all the characteristics before I ever used any drugs or drank any alcohol. We moved from Louisiana in 1969. My father was transferred to Atlanta, Georgia. My oldest sister had moved out of the house, and my brother was 19 at the time, and kind of went back and forth between Atlanta and Louisiana, or Baton Rouge. And the one significant thing I remember about my relationship with my brother is the only time I ever saw my brother that I can remember as a youth was either in the hospital or in prison, and or drunk at home. He had a problem with alcohol and drugs as well, that he has yet really to elect to do anything about, other than stopping the drinking and the drug and the personality stuff that's gone along with it. There hadn't been a lot of change that's taken place in his life. That's taken his inventory, but that's my view. And I have a sister that's immediately in front of me that I guess out of all of my brothers and sisters, or brother and sisters, that I was the closest to, which, and yet we were still very distant. And she used drugs and drank. And even when I was young, I remember letting on that, or trying to put on airs that, yeah, you know, I was cool. I smoked dope and I drank. In reality, I was scared to death of it. I'd read all this information and seen all these stories that, you know, I just thought, God, if I drank or used, especially with the experience of other members of my family that I saw, then I would surely be in big trouble. Well, on transitioning into high school and facing a lot of the peer pressure and whatever that goes on, the changes that took place in my life in that transition, I somehow overcame that fear. I learned to overcome that fear and try. I think really for me it marked a turning point in that I'd gone along for a period of time in my life really making every effort to please my parents or my family, the authority figures in my life, and yet I was very, very unhappy because I just never felt like anything that I did was enough. And I think a lot of it was due to messages that I got that it wasn't enough. And as a result, I came to a point where I just gave up. And I decided, well, I'm sick of trying to live by everybody else's rules and do things according to the way that, quote, I was supposed to. So I really did an about face in my life, and I did start using drugs, and I started drinking. I call myself an alcoholic and a drug addict in the same breath for a very important reason. The very first time that I ever used drugs and drank or ever got affected mentally and as far as my mood was concerned was smoking marijuana and drinking beer. And by the grace of God, the very last time that my mood was altered by a chemical was by smoking marijuana and drinking beer. Now, there was a lot of things that took place in the interim period. I started off, I'd always heard and, you know, or seen on television and in all the ads that, if you smoke pot, like I said earlier, if you smoke pot, then, you know, surely the next week you're going to be down on the Peachtree Street copping heroin and, you know, shooting up. And I thought, you know, this is preposterous. I got cocky and thought, you know, after smoking and trying to be somewhat social with it, I got into harder drugs pretty much straight away. I mean, just like they had said, it was hard to believe. It's like I always put such little faith in it, or just what I had been told, what I considered misinformation. In retrospect, a lot of it was pretty much to the mark in my situation. Now, I had a lot of friends that it wasn't on the mark that I considered possibly were able to use drugs or drink socially. I never was that kind of a person. I never used a drug to improve or to be socially lubricated. I usually ended up so lubricated that I was sprawled out somewhere. And it was not, I don't know that it was really that much, it was a social experience, for me. I know that it made me feel good. It made me feel okay. I finally found something that made me feel like I fit in, that I could, whenever I would drink and use drugs, I was one of the guys. I was one of the gang. I felt a part of, and nobody that ran in that crowd cared about how you looked or how your grades were or if you were playing on the football team at high school or not, or if you were wrestling, or all these things that I had tried at one point and kind of given up because I was so miserable trying to do all these things. And so I really just took a right about face. My grades went from essentially all A's or maybe A's and B's to F's. I had no desire to do well. I had no motivation to do anything with school. I didn't even see myself. I got to a point where I really didn't see myself living past 20, so I didn't know why bother preparing myself for life. I was living one day at a time, you know? And just kind of making do with whatever was available. And when I would have a job, the paycheck would be blown after getting it Friday, a lot of times on Sunday morning or Saturday morning, or get so loaded that and get rolled or have something bad happen to me where, you know, the money would be gone and I'd have to hustle for the next week or 2 weeks to stay high. It got to the point where, for me, I used to live and live to use. It was this very center of my life. It was all that I was. It was all that I did. And I loved it for a period of time. I had fun with it. Looking back now, what I consider fun, you know, laying out puking somewhere in the bushes is not my idea of fun today. At that time, that was my idea of fun, so I had fun with it. I made light a lot of times, you know, the euphoria or living with the euphoria. I liked that, but the trouble was, for me, physically, I could not stay drunk and loaded all the time. It just was not feasible. I didn't know anybody that could all the time. It was always necessary at some point in time to give my body a break. And when that time came, I was miserable. I just felt terrible. And I hated myself. I hated myself for what I was. I hated myself for where I saw myself going, which was nowhere. I was just a very unhappy person. At the age of 14, I was sent off to a military school in Bamberg, South Carolina. My parents' first attempt at giving me some discipline in my life, or at trying to turn me around, which was a flop. After being up there for a short period of time and going AWOL every other night or every night, I'm sure, I was not a happy camper up there. I convinced them we were finally able to make it back to Atlanta with me and myself and some buddies. And we had been abused. We'd been gotten some physical abuse and stuff. And it was enough. And I was a great con, like all of us, I'm sure. I tell my parents all these stories, and you know, whatever you do, just don't send me back here. The next time I run away, you will never see me again. So I conned them into letting me come back home, and that I was going to straighten out my act. I was going to do better. And in the same breath, you know, that very same day, I'm giving them this long spiel, halfway sincere. A friend comes over that had just set up a really good drug connection, and you know, I was like, oh, great, man, I'm back in the swing of things. And so that's the way it went that year. I was doing my own thing. I was running wild. I was crazy. My parents gave up on me. I made my own hours. I pretty much did whatever I wanted to. When I came in contact with the juvenile authority sometimes, and I the law was called to my house at times for fights with myself and my mother or my dad. I really never realized how many brushes I had with the law and the trouble that I had been to my family until I got clean and sober and was able to look back in retrospect and realize that, you know, I was living in hell, sure, but not only was I, but I was putting everybody that was around me in hell. And I didn't feel too good about that. I've since had to make some efforts to make amends to those people, all of my family and other people. At the age of 15, I found IV drugs. I started using drugs IV. I thought I'd found, this was my answer. I'd experimented around and had kind of run the gamut with everything. I think it's just like in the big book where it talks about, you know, changing all your different drinks and, you know, well, this doesn't work, I'll just drink wine, this, so forth, so on. Booze for a long time with me was just something that went along with the drugs. It never registered with me about what my alcohol consumption was. At the end, my preference was shooting PCP or horse tranquilizer and drinking beer. That's what got me to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I credit that abuse. I came very close to dying a couple of times. I was busted and for possession with intent to sell and distribute, and put in the Georgia Mental Health Institute on a court order on a locked ward that same year when I was 15. I didn't want help at that time. I was not ready. I was still had the answers. I was still feeling okay. I still felt healthy, even though I was 6'2", weighed about 138, 140 pounds. I'm still 6'2", and I weigh considerably more today, which some of that's good. I had a real bad experience. One night, I had the occasion to use some hallucinogenic drugs, IV, and had a real horrible experience in that I thought I would never be the same. I thought that I had blown my mind. And I reached out the next day for the first time to somebody to say, you know, hey, man, I called my probation officer and I said, man, I got to move. You know, I got to do something here. My life is in shambles and I'm really seeing it now. And the only way that I could see that I could change that was if I moved or, you know, just changed my surroundings. I didn't realize that maybe there was, maybe I did, but I didn't want to look at the fact that maybe there was something a little deeper going on there. But I got over that. It took me a couple of days to drink myself down and get where I was feeling like a human being again, or halfway like a human being even. And I was back into the same thing, over, back and forth, back and forth. And the drinking was the same, and the horse tranquilizer was the same. And I started having bad blackouts. I started losing days. I remember one particularly funny incident. I came to in my bed one morning and was missing my teeth. I have a bridge in the front of my mouth. And I thought this somewhat peculiar. And I remembered I had been real sick the night before in the bathroom and at a friend's house, by the way, and I'd magically been transported home. Funny how that works. And so I called up these friends of mine who were just getting their day started, about 7:30 in the morning or so, and not thinking anything about it, I asked, well, have you seen my teeth? Yeah. And I don't even think they realized where I was coming from. And they were all doing hallucinogenics. They were just starting to get off on some hallucinogenic drugs. Anybody in here that's done that can relate in that everything seems awfully funny at the outset. And this just complicated matters. After getting them back to the phone 30 minutes later, they actually found them and brought them to me. And I was happy about that. So we proceeded to go off and do our thing, continue to do our thing. But things were getting bad. I really started noticing my life was in shambles. I quit high school, and my probation officer didn't like that too much and asked that I, now he requested in a pretty strong way that I reconsider. And so I went to enrolled myself in a day program at an open campus facility, which is a little more loose than the standard public schools or whatever. And I just did not have the discipline to make it. This school, they let you go. They allowed you three absences like every 6 weeks or something like that, which is actually pretty liberal. But after about the first week, I had blown that. And by allowing you three absences, that was it. If you had that, then you were out, at least for the next 6 weeks. Which actually turned out to be pretty good. I like that. But what was happening to me is my body was really getting sick, and so was my mind. I was losing control. I was no longer in touch at all with reality. I didn't know, and it really started scaring me, I think. I found myself one morning after a particularly hard binge, rummaging through a friend of mine's house looking for his drugs or the drugs that he had stolen from me, just tearing the place apart. Now the thing about this is it's about 7:30 in the morning and everybody was home and in bed and asleep until I, you know, woke everybody up. And that didn't make me the most popular guy there. And these were some running buddies of mine, and we all worked each other over. And it really had an impact on me. It really helped me to realize that, man, you know, these were the last contact, the last semblance of friends, really, that I had. And it started, more and more things started registering to me. Man, you're really going down the tubes. You're losing your mind. You're going to be dead soon if something doesn't change, or you're going to continue like this indefinitely, which would have been just as bad. So time went on after that incident. I had some more long blackouts, and that really scared me a lot. I came to one Saturday morning sometime beginning of April or in March, possibly, of 1977, and realized that I had something had to give. Something was going to give one way or the other. And my mom came by my room, and she heard me in there, I guess, crying or just out of control, and asked if there was something that she could do. And I said, yeah, I need help. I'm hurting. And so I went and enrolled in an outpatient program, a place called DAC, DeKalb Addiction Center, in Atlanta. And I went down there and went through all the paperwork and went home. I started feeling better. I kind of was pulling myself together somewhat. And that afternoon, I had a friend come over, and he brought some marijuana and I think just marijuana, and we smoked, because that was just normal. What was giving me trouble was the hard drugs. I needed to quit the hard drugs, the tranquilizers, and just using the needle in general. I got into where everything that I did, practically, I used IV, and it was getting to be summertime again. And anybody that's used drugs IV, you don't want to wear short sleeve shirts when that's going on. And that really, I don't know that was it so much. I had a lot of blood disorders, a lot of physical things were going on with me as a result of that were really, really making me feel bad and look bad. So I had a lot of false starts in the beginning. I started going to this outpatient program, and then I got introduced to another anonymous fellowship. I did not consider myself an alcoholic when I first started seeking help. I knew I was a dope addict. So as a result, I went to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. I'm told that I was at several NA meetings before I remember ever being at one. The first one that I do remember being at, I remember thinking to myself, walking into the room, was, my God, here I am with all the people that the Salvation Army wouldn't take. You know, I looked through over the room, I said, holy jeez. Of course, there wasn't a mirror handy, so, you know, I couldn't look and see that, hey, you know, here you are, pal, and you have put yourself in this position. And don't get any ideas that you're any better than any of these people here, or any different. So I got introduced to an anonymous fellowship, a 12-step program. At that time in Atlanta, there were two or three meetings, NA meetings, three or four actually NA meetings a week. I think one was in Marietta. And I started going to these meetings, and I was also started going to, they were sneaking these in on me, I realized later, young people AA meetings, and I couldn't note a difference. Of course, the first several months, I didn't note a whole lot of things. But it felt right. It felt good. I felt comfortable in these meetings, as comfortable as you feel when you get sober. You know, now physically, sometimes that's not a whole lot. Tonight, that wasn't a whole lot before I got up here, by the way. Feel much better now. I guess it has to do with being in control, or thinking one is. So I started in Narcotics Anonymous. I got a sponsor. A man elected himself to be my sponsor. He came up to me and saw that I was not capable to grasp this concept of sponsorship or reach out. So he reached out, and he went more than 50-50. He went all the way for me. This man called me probably every night for 2 months and invited me to come to a meeting and brought me to a meeting. Some nights I'd ride a bus. Some nights I'd hitchhike, however I could get. If he had a date or something like that, of course, that's one hazard of getting here young, you know, and you got young people, they want to go out on dates and things like that. Which I think is good now that I'm in my position. So I got started and was getting a taste. And I had, but yet even at the beginning, I had an experience. I wanted to be able to still sell drugs. I did not. I figured this was the only way I really knew how to make money. And even and then I was fooling myself because I never made money. It always ended up in me, and I always ended up broke. But I put a con on myself and said, here this last time you triple your money, you're going to be, you can get set up enough time, give yourself enough time to get a job and get squared away. So I bought some drugs and ended up that very night in Grady Memorial Hospital in Atlanta, close to dead, later on the psychiatric ward there, and just out of my mind. And here once again, at this point, I convinced myself that I could not use drugs or drink. Really, I was even getting on thinking about the alcohol, but I really couldn't do either one successfully. Yet there I was. I was back in the same situation, sick and disgusted with myself. My parents came and got me, and I was really humiliated. I felt horrible, you're just going to have to watch me die like this because there's nothing I can do. Cannot fight this. I can't do without it. So I kind of resigned myself to it, yet I still reached out. I called and I went to a meeting and really listened, I think, for the first time. The next night, excuse me. Glass of water. So I started listening at the meetings. And my sponsor listened, and he was very patient with me, and he took care of me, really, like I said, for a couple of months there. And then he was kind of letting me get out on my own. I was in this program as well. He was kind of pushing me out on my own. I was without a job for this time because I was in this program during the day, and I started having some free time, and I started having time to think. And I quit. He started expecting me to call him and do some things, to indicate that yes, I'm willing to make an effort here. I'm willing, I wanna be sober. I wanna be clean. Well, there were some other interests that I had at the time, and I was still hanging around some people that were not healthy for me. Doing things, as a real novelty for me. Hey, they have a saying in Atlanta, and I'm sure in a lot of groups around the country, playmates and playgrounds, they got to change. And I didn't have a whole lot when I got here, but the ones that I could hang on to or try and weasel around, I tried to stay sick. And it was a novelty that I was there, and, here I'd been in a guy, some guy's room shooting dope a few weeks before. Now I was clean and just, feeling all full of piss and vinegar and ready to, be okay and just kind of hang out. And besides, there was a pool handy where this guy lived, and there were cute girls there, and I thought, this is great, But a lot of people got high also. See, I didn't let this bother me for a while. And I just ignored that. But my defenses slowly but surely they ebbed away. And I didn't make efforts to go to meetings. My parents were out of town a lot. They were in the process of looking for a home to move. And I was up in the air about a lot of things. I really was convinced, I'd been to enough meetings to know that there was a way out if I was willing to do the work. And that I didn't have to be the way that I was if I chose not to be. But I just had this, I don't know what it was, just this little streak or little voice in me, monkey on my back, that just, when confronted with a new and a difficult situation, did not always say the right thing. And what happened is a friend of mine came over to my house when I had been around, been dry for about 2.5 months or so. And he said, "Gosh, I hadn't seen you in a long time. You're looking so good. the car's running in the driveway. I got a case of beer, and I got, you know, our cooler full of beer and a bunch of pot. Let's go out and have a good time. I said, sure. We're on our way. And didn't think that much. I probably would have thought better about it had I been going to some meetings and kind of maintaining myself. You know, they say we have a daily reprieve, contingent on the maintenance of the spiritual program or maintenance of our spiritual condition. And I had no spiritual condition at that time other than poor. So as a result, I went out and I used. And I felt just dead. I didn't have any bolts of lightning, you know. I didn't immediately go out and blow my brains out. You know, all these things, you know, like they've been so melodramatic at meetings. Well, the next time you go out, well, you might just drive your car off a cliff. Or, you know, just all these things. It's like, you know, back to the old scare tactics. They use this in elementary school. I'm used to this. However, by the way, I'm sad to report that a friend of mine went out again, and that is exactly what happened to him in California. Exactly. But it didn't happen to me. I went out and was hanging out with kind of some of the old cronies back when I had really tried to be social with it, and hanging out in a pool hall. That's a good place to be. And I just looked around, man, like everybody I saw, I mean, really, we were all going nowhere. I just kind of saw just for the first time, just really became crystal clear that I couldn't drink alcohol and use drugs and enjoy it anymore. It was no longer that, it no longer worked. Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous had taken that privilege away from me. So if you want to continue to drink and use drugs, you better go while the getting's good. You may have been here too long already. And that's exactly the way that I view it. It just took away that option for me. It's you know, and I'm happy to report tonight that, I guess it's been 3 or 4 years now, that the option of suicide is no longer viable, you know, considered as viable. And that's real progress for me. It was progress when I no longer considered drinking and drugging an option. But I still held on, you know, well, if it really gets bad, hell, I'll just kill myself. You know? And everybody will be so sad. And God, that is so sick. But I held on to that as an option. I'm not here to do a song and dance and tell you how wonderful my life has been or how wonderful I have felt, you know, in this great euphoria ever since I started getting serious about being sober. That hadn't been how it's worked for me. I have had to work and put an effort forth to stay sober. And I'm not going to sit up here and BS you and tell you, you know, give you some story like, oh, it's just so wonderful. It's just, you know, and it is. The reality of it is that in most respects, it is. My life is better than it has ever been. But I still have crummy days. Hell, I still have crummy weeks sometimes. But I have something that I can turn to. I have this higher power, God as I understand Him, that I can turn to and ask for strength. One thing I noted in the big book, after being around here for a while, was a place in chapter 4 where it says, after mentioning that, kind of casually, that lack of power, that's our dilemma, the entire purpose of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, is so that each and every one of us can find a power by which we can live. And the way that I understand that power doesn't have to be the same way as the next guy understands that power or the next guy. I love it where it talks about in I think it's Bill's story, when one of the guys from the Oxford groups comes and shares, and in the course of the conversation, the statement is made, well, why don't you choose a God of your understanding? And the statement following is, after that, the after that, He was no longer standing in the shadow of this icy intellectual mountain in which he had shivered for years. And that really felt good, reading that and really getting in touch with that. That, yeah, you know, I was brought up in the Southern Baptist religion, or in the Southern Baptist Church. My parents are still good members in good standings of the Southern Baptist Church. And I've somewhat had to work through a resentment about that, I think. And I'm not putting that down, because I think, you know, we all have our own spiritual paths. But for me, it didn't, the way that I tried, it didn't work. And what I heard didn't work for me. And what I found here has. And I've gone through some periods in my sobriety where I have really questioned God's will and what's going on in my life, or what should I do, or am I doing the right thing? Is this okay? And the one thing that I've learned, or that I've found and really hold on to and hold very dear, as a foundation of the spiritual program that I have, is that God does not make hard terms with those that seek Him. And as long as I am seeking Him and seeking to do His will, I feel that I will be in His grace. Otherwise, I don't think I'd be sober tonight. There's a few things, you know, for me, what I had to learn at first was there are a few things, few bottom line pieces of information that I needed to get started. And one was that it is not God's will for me to drink alcohol. And it is not God's will for me to use drugs in any way, shape, or form, which includes quite a few ways today. And there's a lot of stuff out there now I'm learning that, you know, that I never had a chance to try. It's like all these new designer drugs and wine coolers and a lot of sissy drinks, or, you know, I don't know. That's okay with me today, and that's got to be okay with me today. I have to let go of these reservations, and I admit, I'm not going to stand up here before you tonight and say that there have not been times in my sobriety when I have really questioned where I've been as far as not taking a drink is concerned, and wanting to stay here. And it's usually when times are just kind of in between, not really bad, not really good. That's when I really have to make an effort to stay close to God. When the shit hits the fan, me and God, man, we are right on, you know. It's like, hey, okay, whatever you got next, I'm okay with that, you know. Whatever you got planned, you just let me know. Because I know that's where my strength lies. And likewise, when things are going really good, because I think that I know that inside of me, I do about as bad a job with success as I do with failure and middle of the road. So I need a lot of help. And they say for me, or one thing I heard in a meeting early on that I love is, I'm here because I'm not all there. And that's really great for me. That helps me to remember, kind of keep a little perspective. And some of the tools that I learned early on that I think are very important to me today as well was when I get up in the morning, I ask God, first of all, I acknowledge the fact that I am an alcoholic and an addict. And I ask God if He will help me to stay free from drugs and alcohol for that day. And I thank Him at night. And if it's nothing more than that, it's a lot of times I don't have time to sit down and be, you know, real specific and elaborate and go through all this great motion that I used to think was so necessary to get contact. I've also learned that if you don't get away from the basics, you don't have to go back to the basics. That's real important for me, because a lot of times I've caught myself in meetings saying, well, I guess it's time for me to get back to the basics. And what I have to realize when I'm saying that is, you know, hey, somewhere along the line I got away. And if I don't feel close to God, guess who moved? It's, you know, I don't think He does a lot of moving. Pursue that. I don't know. I think for me, another big area, or one area that's proven indispensable in my recovery, has been a relationship with a sponsor. The guy that first took me under his wing when I came into the fellowship. My parents moved shortly afterwards when I was 16 when I got here in 77. My parents moved when at that time in, I think, September of 1977, and I elected to stay in Atlanta. And they were happy about that. And I think they... more ways than one, obviously. So that was good for them. They kind of got the last kid out of the nest, and they started doing some things that they wanted to do. And also, I moved in with my sponsor, my first sponsor, and his mother, and his brother, who at the time was running with a lot of the guys that I had run with, which was not a very comfortable situation. But he got into the program. He finally is in the fellowship now, married and has a child and doing quite well, I'm happy to report, after a few false starts. I think a lot of us have that problem. So I lived there for about 6 months, and really that helped me immensely get indoctrinated and really make the meetings and really be involved. We had a meeting there that we held every Sunday night, and it really helped me. Home groups were real important to me. I really could feel comfortable. I felt like I could share honestly and just kind of talk about what was on my mind. And I think a lot of other people felt very much at ease, and we got to be real good friends. And really to help each other in a meaningful, and communicate in a meaningful way, as opposed to a lot of times in meetings, for whatever reason, I feel like there's some superficiality that goes on. I guess, you know, we just get such in the habit of, hi, how you doing? Oh, I'm doing fine. How you doing? You know, the old AA smile, the AA armor. You know, you go to a meeting, you suit up, and I got my emotional armor on now, and anybody ask me, I'm okay. When inside, a lot of times, you know, with me, I can be dying inside, and I mean, unless my guts are coming out and I'm tripping all over them, I'm probably not going to say anything. Oh, fine, yeah, good to talk to you. And that's not what it's all about, I'm learning. And that is a lesson that has been a long time coming for me. Pride runs very deep in me. False pride. And a lot of times it endeavors to separate me from my fellow man, which is really the core of why I got here in the first place, was because I was separate from my fellows. I had no camaraderie. I had no God to talk about. I had no God to share. I was spiritually, morally, physically, mentally bankrupt when I got here. And a lot of that before I even started taking drinks and drugs. That was just simply a symptom with me, just like it says in the book. And now what I have to look at is really getting down to, you know, what do I do? How do I live that requires change? What do I do? How do I function that separates me, that keeps me apart from? What can I do to keep this ego of mine in check? You know, how do I ease God out? That I have to look at today, and I have to really make a lot of times an exerted effort to put myself in check when I see it happening. I've had a lot of ups and downs, and as far as relationships, both romantic and non-romantic, since I've been in the program. A lot of people, the one thing that I learned, I guess, is that, you know, one thing about alcoholics is that they drink. And one thing about addicts is that they do drugs and they use. And a lot of times people are going to do that until they're in the grave. And there may be interludes in which they stop, and in which they make an effort to grasp recovery and fall back. My first sponsor has had a lot of, at 4 or 5 years, he elected to drink and use drugs again. my second sponsor, recently elected to just leave his wife and leave town and leave no clue as to where or what he was going to do. My sponsors that I both use today, I'm happy to report, one has just celebrated his 29th birthday, and another just celebrated, I think, 14, are upstanding members of the community and doing quite well, and are really people that I love and respect deeply. May have had the way that my first few sponsors turned out may have had something to do with my selection process of the people that I identified with. It may just be the fact that they're alcoholics and they don't know any other way. I have a friend that saved my life, literally, at one point in time when suicide was still an option for me. I went through a period of time where I was involved with someone for 6 years, through my teenage years and on into my 20s, that we ended up going our separate ways. And it was pretty ugly, a lot of the circumstances in which that occurred. And I wanted to take my own life for a period of time. But I went to meetings, and I tried to, you know, I was mad as hell at God. I was not very happy. But there was one guy in particular that really held my hand, really walked me through a lot of the pain, and I really credit him with saving me a few times from hurting myself. He elected to return and has now been declared mentally incapable of taking care of himself, so he gets a check from the state. He's supported by the state because he's been declared incompetent. But I also believe that where there's life, there's hope. I've seen a lot of amazing things in this program. I had a good friend that came around for 6 and 7 years, 6 or 7, I can't recall, and would show up at dances drunk, show up at AA functions all messed up, and we had just all practically written him off of just, you know, God, John, you're just going to die like this, you know, no response. But today, he has, I believe, 8 years, and is married, has a family, and is doing those things that I'm sure he couldn't even have dreamed of when he was in his prior situation. My own life, some of the things that have gone on in the superficial sense, or in the sense of some of the benefits that I've reaped, quote, out there. By the way, I hate the expression earth people. I mean, what are we, man? Are we Martians or something? I don't know if that's even a popular expression up here, but I just have to express that. I hate that. Because I think the only thing that separates me from anybody else or any other person is the fact that I cannot use alcohol and I cannot use drugs to deal with my problems. I've given up that privilege today. But aside from that, I mean, I feel that we're all human beings. That's strictly my own feeling. And we all have our problems to deal with. I lost my train of thought. Must have been going nowhere. I got derailed somewhere along the line. Yes. Now it just came back online. The benefits that I've received, some of the benefits that I've received materially since getting sober, is I'm capable of supporting myself today. I can put a roof over my head. I can put gas in my automobile. I can feed myself. And that is a far cry from where I got started. I was incapable of all of those things when I got started. If it weren't for the good graces of my parents and these friends, these good Samaritans, in the beginning, I don't know where I would be today. I may well be dead. But by the grace of God, they were in my life. I went back to school. I finished high school at night. I kept a full-time job during the day initially, and went to college of all things. Here I was, I had no plans past my 20s. When I hit 20 years old, it was a dream. I was like, I cannot believe I'm living this long, that I'm still on this earth. It's really a gift. I went to college. I got an undergraduate degree at the North Avenue Trade School there, which is Georgia Tech. And in mechanical engineering, and I stayed on to get a master's degree. From that point, I took a year off and went and lived on the beach, which was something of a dream of mine, for a year, and worked for a defense contractor out in Southern California. And I made arrangements to come back and work on my PhD at Georgia Tech, which I'm currently endeavoring to complete. And that's been quite a challenge in my life in the last 3.5 years. I was doing some of my research work when I was employed by this company out in California, Southern California. So that's a little bit of what's gone on for me on the surface. A lot of really good things. If I had been writing the script, I would have shortchanged myself by far. My highest ambition on coming to the program was to get a technical degree or a trade school degree and be a welder. And I'm not discrediting that by any stretch of the imagination. It's just my desires and my ambition, were so far off from where I could go. And I had no self-esteem. I did not like the person that walked through these doors. I hated their guts. And one of the first things I really had to work on was self-esteem. I prayed. I started praying pretty early on. And if you haven't started or haven't tried it, at least experiment. Give it a chance. Anybody, contempt prior to investigation. I love in the book where it talks at the very end, it says that there is one thing more than anything that will keep us forever, just in everlasting ignorance of what life can have in store for us, and that is contempt prior to investigation. Now, if I don't believe the prayer is going to work, or if I don't even try it, then how can I ever check it out? I consider myself a scientist today, and if there's something proposed to me that seems reasonable and that will benefit me, then I'm going to at least experiment and try and see if it works. And the prayer experiment has been a smashing success. There have been times in my life since I've been sober, that emotionally, or a lot of things on the surface were just in an uproar, or just be in terrible shape emotionally in most other ways. Yet inside, there was always that some still small voice within, or something I was paraphrasing or quoting out of the book, possibly just some calm within me that I could always go to and say, okay, I know that things are tough right now. I know I'm in that things are turbulent. I'm going through all these difficulties, but I can hold on to something. I have something solid in which I can hold on to. And that is really, there's been a lot of times that I have looked back in my sobriety and wondered how I made it, how I didn't drink, how I didn't kill myself, how I didn't just die from the emotional pain that I was going through. But I've gotten through. So it's like the poem In His Steps, when you look back and wonder how was I carried? How did I get through these times? They're just gray periods in my life that I've been transported through. And One has been rather recent, actually. According to some initial plans that I have made, or some previous engagements, pardon the pun, I was considering getting married this month, and had somebody special in my life, and that didn't work out, and fell apart. Matter of fact, in the end of January, and initially I thought when I would be coming here that we'd be here together, and it didn't work out. And as a result of that, like all other emotionally trying times since I've been sober, I've learned how much other people in the program really do love me if I let them. And I've learned how to let people in. Like I said, that's a lesson that's been very slow in coming for me. My pride is very strong and really fights allowing others to be emotionally close to me. I've always kept myself somewhat isolated from others. Emotionally, it's like, you know, yeah, I'm the rock, I'm an island, and I don't want anybody messing with me. Nothing's going to shake this. Nothing's going to shake this inside of me. But when I do that, I can't let others inside to nurture me and to share with me their spiritual strength and their emotional strength when I hurt. And it's not a very happy way to live. And so what it means for me, you know, when they talk about the steps is our ego deflation. They involve ego deflation at death. To me, I think the whole program, that's what it's about, ego deflation at death. Because in reality, or in the final analysis, the only thing that stands between me and my fellows and really communicating is my ego. And that's the toughest. I got here and it was real sick, and it needed all this attention and all this. There's just a lot of sickness involved there. And working the steps and trying to let the other people in the program in and acting as if a lot of times, and just showing up, I have been able to get somewhat better, get that thing out of the way sometimes, and let other people know me. And it's felt good, and it's been a real healing experience for me. I'm glad to be sober tonight, and I'm glad to be here. Thanks.